I'm Peter Guagenti. I'm president and chief marketing officer of Tab9. Tab9 is the AI coding assistant that you control. I am a coffee addict, and I am usually, if you find me at a coffee shop, it'll be a dry cappuccino. At home, it's just black coffee from the pot.
Welcome back to another MLOps Community Podcast. I am your host, Dimitrios. Today, we're talking with Peter G. Wow. I loved it. Okay, I'm going to be straight with you all. I usually say no to people that reach out to me, and if they are not engineers or they do not have a technical background, I usually will say, no, not right now, maybe later, and later never comes, let's be honest. This is the first time that I had someone from a marketing department on the podcast, but I do not look at Peter as a marketer. He talked about his whole life and how he started in tech and how he went through so many different companies, building companies, selling companies, joining companies. And the reason I wanted to have him on here was because of his diverse range of experience. Right now he's a marketer, but he's been in product. He's led teams that dealt with ML and AI. He's also been the CEO of a company that scales from 20 to 300 people. So I felt like he had a lot to offer. This was not sponsored in any way. I'm going to come right out and say it. I was not held with a gun to my head to have him on. It was my choice. I really wanted to see what we could get into in this conversation. And I am very glad that we did, because he gave me some antidotes that I was needing to hear. I really appreciated the conversation. I would also love to hear what you all thought about it. I know there's been a few people that have reached out to me that have asked about bridging the barriers between the technical teams and the business teams, and how to make sure that all stakeholders are happy when you are dealing with data, data products, machine learning products. This feels like it is a conversation for all of those people that have reached out to me asking for that. If you just want to hear the nitty-gritty on the tech and on what the newest, latest, and greatest tools and methods, architectures, system designs are, then we've got a whole lot of other material for you. But if you're interested in getting some insights around how to build a more effective team when it comes to technical and business stakeholders, this is what we got into today. There were so many nuggets in here. I can't even begin to list them off because it will take me at least 20 minutes. And I think it's better that we just get into the conversation. I will drop this bomb on you. Peter G is hiring. The company is hiring for engineers, machine learning engineers, like crazy right now. They're growing. They're doing so well. And you may be using them. You may have heard of them. They are a coding solution. It seems like the coding space, the AI-generated code space, is one that is blowing up right now. Just on this podcast, in the last 8 months, we've had 4 people that are doing something in the code generation space. And none of those people worked at Copilot, the big name in this space. What I love about the space is that all of these different companies are having to differentiate themselves in one way or another. I know there's a lot of people out there that are using coding tools and coding assistants to help them get more done. So if you're that person and you've been using it, what I really would like to hear from you is how much of your code stays in the code base 4 weeks after you merge that PR. That's what I really want to know, because we got into a bit of a survey that just came out recently, today actually, on how much of the code that is accepted from GitHub Copilot ends up having to go and be completely rewritten 4 weeks after it is accepted. So if you're using some Copilot or some coding assistant, let us know. I want to know, is it worth the hassle? Does it really power up all of your abilities? Or is it something that you have to go back and refactor once or twice a week. Let's get into this conversation with Peter. Hope you all enjoy. And as always, it would mean the world to me if you share this with just one friend. Just one friend. Let them know. MLOps community, we out here doing it. Let's get into this combo. Peter, we got to start, man, with the exact same way that I started the call with you a week ago. Tell me about that skateboard, because it is the centerpiece. I can't stop staring at it.
Okay, so I was a derelict as a teenager. I was a sponsored skateboarder as a teenager. Grew up in New York City, and skateboarding was my outlet. Actually taught me creativity. Actually, that community taught me DIY and entrepreneurialism, and so it's always been my roots. And the board specifically behind me is it's a recreation of a very famous skater, this guy Mike Vallely out of the East Coast. It was one of the first sort of double-ended boards that was sort of the shape that became the primary shape all skaters used. And so when he reissued it, he did a limited run, autographed and numbered by him. I had to do it. I had the original of that deck. I used the hell out of it and ended up in a bin, I'm sure, at some point. So it was great to get the recreation of it.
Were you skating pools or parks or handrails? What are you talking here?
Yeah, I was a street skater. So I grew up in New York City. So I was a skater in the late 80s, early 90s, sort of at the heyday of street skating. When street skating sort of was born. This is pre-X Games. This is like they did the first X Games just as I was getting out of the sport. So this is when skateboarding was not cool. It was sort of the dead zone in between the Vert era and the X Games era. But a lot of folks, you know, like a lot of the kids I grew up with, you know, these are the founders now of Supreme. These are the guys who ended up running skateboarding at the big companies like Levi's and Adidas and others. So it was a great era to come up, right? It really was.
So now you said it taught you entrepreneurship. You had and have had and are continuing to have a bit of a run when it comes to starting companies. Maybe let's just start there. Like, when did you first get the bug? What was the first company? Break it down for us.
Yeah. I like to joke that I was born an entrepreneur. Even when I was a skater, I always have a little side hustle. I did a little clothing brand and a skateboard deck brand for a little bit. That was just low production, sold in the local shops in the tri-state area in New York. But when I was in school, so I was in university in the mid 90s, and when I was in school was the birth of the web. Right? It was the start of all this stuff. And I'd been paying my way through school working as a photojournalist and was doing content creation and other things and had an NEA grant for a publication that I was doing. And someone came up to me at a computer lab in 94 and said, "Hey, you should put this on the internet. You'd reach such a bigger audience." And I was like, "What the hell is the internet?" Right? It was 1994, right? So by summer of 95, I was doing a bunch of web development tonight. I got an opportunity to do some contract work. So I built the first website for People Magazine, did a bunch of work for some of the record labels or the media companies in New York. So in 96, I ended up starting a digital agency. So two worlds simultaneously, building websites, building web applications, doing sort of the earliest eras of digital transformation, and then doing digital marketing, you know, at the time. And that was a very new thing. I built and sold that company in a year and a half and then went and did it again. So sold that company to a holding company and then moved to the West Coast, joined a group of guys who were trying to do the same thing, and took that company from 20 to almost 300 in a few years and sold that to one of the big holding companies. And
wow,
that was it. That sort of gave me the bug. So I've been in tech now for, you know, almost 30 years, so just a little shy of 30 years. Always in digital transformation, always in transformative technology, and loved it. You know, I've always loved it. So fast forward to today, you know, I was in services businesses for years, you know, and then switched into software companies. I've been in some companies that folks would know. I was early employee at Acquia behind the Drupal open source project. That was a huge, huge win for us. Mm-hmm. I was at Nginx, built that company up from just a Russian open source project to being the powerhouse that they became. I've been in data companies, AI companies, you know, and now I'm at an AI for software developer company. And then I'm an investor and advisor at a number of companies and MLOps and AI and in other core parts of data infrastructure, which I think is really interesting right now.
It always amazes me when I hear these stories about people back in the day building websites and how easily it was that these gigantic companies were just letting kids build their websites, because it was almost like the internet was so low stakes that you were like, yeah, all right, we kind of need something there. You could go and I can only imagine what the conversations you had with People Magazine were. Like, hey, we should probably get you a website, right? You want that?
And actually, it wasn't as low stakes as you might think. I remember when I first put people.com live, I convinced them in 95, I convinced them not just to put the regular publication up, but to do like custom content, which was radical at the time. And their big thing at the time was like, sexiest man alive, sexiest woman alive. There's all these like great things. And I convinced them that we should put up like the extended galleries of these people, because they have all these great photos that they took. So I put up extended galleries of these people, not just what was in the publication, which was just one photo of each. And we got over a million uniques in 1 week on the property, which
in 95,
there were like not that many people on the freaking internet. And there was not that many people with actually like fast enough access to be looking at all of this stuff. So it was not as low stakes as you might think it is, although it is really funny. I mean, I was 19 years old when I did that, right? I think about it now, like there's no way in hell, you know, a top 20 media brand would let some 19-year-old get access to their platform nowadays. But at the time, you nailed it. There were very few of us who understood it. There were very few of us who were doing it. I definitely was more mature than my years at the time, but a lot of it was just, I was in a space that was really interesting and exciting, and you know, I was one of a limited number of people who was and who cared about it. I'll tell you, it's easy to look back now, and you know, yourself and maybe many of your viewers are folks who aren't even, they weren't even born when the browser started, right? But I remember in the mid-90s, late-90s, having conversations with CEOs and saying, this is the future. Like, this is not just another channel. Like, we are going to do everything through the internet. Because why wouldn't we, right? And it was impossible for them to understand. And then you fast forward just 10 years and you think about the whole world flipped on its ear, particularly when the iPhone came out, because the iPhone was not a phone. The iPhone was the first truly personal computer, right? It was the fulfillment of Steve Jobs' vision, you know, 30 years earlier of putting a computer in everybody's hands, right? It just happened to literally be in your hand, right? And so, you know, I remember going through those eras. And I feel like we're going through the same thing with AI right now. I've been at AI companies now for 8 years. And I remember having these conversations even 4 or 5 years ago, like, you don't understand, AI is going to change everything. Every app will change. Every business will change. All of our processes will change. And people will tell me I'm crazy, right? There's no way. And I think now we're finally starting to see it.
I can only imagine what the hosting costs for the people.com extended galleries were.
They were ridiculous.
So I agree with everything else you're saying. So forgive me for continuing to harp on this in the 90s, but that is probably ridiculous.
Oh yeah, no, they had their own data center. They had their own data center. It was pretty remarkable. I'll tell you just how you think about like DevOps. I mean, how far DevOps has come, and even scripting. Like, I used to actually have to be in the office at, you know, 9-10 o'clock at night to push the site live every week.
Then moved to California, got involved in the same kind of thing, built another company, sold it. You thought, hey, it worked once. Why not test my luck, see if it works twice? Built the company, gigantic company, and up to 300 people, impressive stuff. I know you mentioned having a few tips and tricks when it comes to selling companies and teaching, almost like helping us learn from your experience.
Yeah.
Of selling companies, building selling companies, particularly selling companies, is quite interesting. I can imagine, especially in this environment, maybe there are companies out there that have raised too much or that are just ready to get out of the game.
Yeah.
What are things that you learned when you sold your various companies?
Yeah. Well, you know, the craziest thing about this is you never go into a company expecting to sell it, right? That's never the thing. You know, the first agency I sold, I knew the company I sold to was inside of one of the big advertising holding companies when they were starting to roll all these companies together. And they were friends. They knew me. They knew my work. They knew my team. I had a team of 30 people doing really interesting work, which is actually how I was able to sell it and not stick around, because they were, you know, they knew what they were getting because they knew me really well and they knew my people. And so, and the same thing with the second agency sale. I was actually pitching services to a big Fortune 50 brand, actually. And it was in their offices, and it was myself and my CEO and a couple others. And, you know, we won the business, but in the room was a senior executive from their traditional ad agency who actually was responsible for M&A. And so, you know, she called us a week later and said, you know, I was really impressed with you guys. You're amazing. Would you be open to us acquiring a piece of the business? We want to expose you to more people. We want to get you into other accounts. We want to help you scale, and we think we could do better together. And so, you know, these things happen when you least expect them. And his software was, you know, different. Like, you know, Acquia was a sale to private equity, and it was a good sale, right? It was Vista ended up acquiring the company. The company had built a really strong independent business. It was cash flow positive. But was missing that next level of scale that it wanted, right? And you know, Vista came in, and it was a great thing. Or Nginx was a similar story. The company had been scaling, it was growing at a healthy rate, but there were all these big install base companies that were in controlling that category in the Fortune 500, and could walk, you know, Nginx into 50 times the number of customers that they could do on their own. And so the best way to sell a company is to not try to sell a company, right? The best way to sell a company is actually to go and build a healthy, independent business that's differentiated in space and has customers who love them, right? And this is the secret of every business. The purpose of a business is not to create a product. The purpose of a business is not to create revenue. The purpose of a business is to create and keep customer relationships. And if you have customers who love you and you have deep relationships with them, you will generate profit, you will generate healthy revenue, and you will have an attractive business that somebody will want to be part of. So, you know, I think that's the focus. Now, when you get to a level of duress where you need to sell, which I think is happening right now, I think a lot of people raise money to try to build businesses. It was so easy to raise capital, even if the idea wasn't good, right? Or so easy to raise capital, even if maybe you didn't have the skills to do it. Like, and that's a fair thing to admit, right? As an entrepreneur, I have my strengths. I also have things that I'm terrible at, right? And some people don't make it because they can't get the right staff. Maybe they don't actually get to that breakthrough. That's a different point. Then my best advice to people when they're in that situation where they have to sell is, if you still love your baby, you still want it to thrive, then reach out directly to the companies that you think that your team and your product could thrive in, right? And I've seen that happen. I've had some companies that I've advised and invested in over the years that had to do those sales. I had an AI company that did that. But their thing was they're super happy with where they ended up, because the reality is they're surrounded by people who get their vision. They're surrounded by people who really understand them and understand what they're trying to do. And they were able to keep chasing their dream inside of a large company instead of trying to do it on their own inside of a small software company.
Yeah. And can you speak a little bit more to people not having the skill sets to execute on their vision? You mentioned not being able to recruit the talent as being one. I've been through my fair share of startups, and I feel like each time I encounter a new problem as to why, but I also am kind of backseat driving, right? Like, I don't have the stress or the pressure of millions of dollars on my back. So it's easy for me to be like, well, this guy doesn't know what the fuck he's doing, or this person is way out of line with how they're running this business, because like I just can't know what I would do in that situation. Yeah. And so I feel like you've seen it firsthand, and maybe there are things that you have felt as you develop as an entrepreneur that you recognize now. 20 years ago, you did not have that skill set.
Yeah, I'll give you my sort of foundational theory of successful startups, right? If you're going to be in a tech company, then there's two core functions that every person in a software startup needs to fall into, and you need both equally. They both need equal weight, and they're hackers and hustlers. And what do I mean by that? So it's technology people and go-to-market people, right? But more importantly, it's the right mindset of technology people and go-to-market people. Hackers say yes, right? You need people in a technology role in startups that aren't going to tell you all the reasons why something can't be done. They're going to sit there and hustle and figure out, like, what is the way I do make it happen? What, how do I make that real? Because the act of creating a business is the act of generating something from nothing. And if it was an easy thing to generate that, a business would already exist. Somebody would already be doing it, right? And so you have to embrace this mindset of, I'm going to make it happen no matter what. And that sort of hacker mindset, not the negative, you know, breaking systems hacker definition, but the, like, I'm gonna just DIY until it's real, right? That mindset, I'll tell you, I've been able to work with some really, really remarkable computer scientists over the course of my career. Some of the top, you know, top 1%. And they all share that. They all share that that mindset of, I can see the way forward. I believe in it, and I will bring it to life, right? I will reach hurdles along the way, but I will come over those hurdles and I will make it happen. Where I feel like software has gone wrong, you know, for the last, I mean, gosh, it's been at least 10, 15 years now, was the diminishing of the go-to-market side of the house, right? Because there's this whole thing of, you know, Mark Andreessen was famous for pushing technical founder CEOs. But, you know, if you come from a technical background, you don't know how to sell. You don't know how to market. In fact, I would always argue with some of my peers at some of the tech companies I've worked at, as a software engineer, your world is math and physics, right? Your world is formulas that balance out, right? They come down to a simple thing. But sales and marketing is psychology and sociology. So the formulas don't balance out. And in fact, you don't really know 100% for certain why anything. Right? You know, an example I always use with my technical founders is, you know that higher education rates in a society reduce crime rates, right? Okay. No one's been ever able to actually show you a direct causation in that. No one's ever been able to actually trace that out, right? But it's just two data points. That's what it is. The marketing and sales is the same way. Why did, you know, if I spend money on awareness advertising, the business grows. Can I show a direct correlation? No. Until I can put a chip in someone's brain and keep track of everything they've seen and felt, I'll never know for sure, right? But you have to have both sides of those coins. And the hustler mindset says, I'm going to build a brand. I'm going to build a business. I'm going to make money no matter what. And the irony of all of this is the most successful businesses in technology over the last 50 years usually were not the best product. They were the best go-to-market, right? Very rarely have we seen best product, that one. Very rarely, right? I mean, the iPhone being another great example of, like, best product and best go-to-market combined, right? But I guarantee if you look back over the history of even products you've used, like, oh, I love that thing, and they didn't make it, right? This other company ended up taking the category, right?
100%. The graveyards are littered with incredible products, and I find it funny, too, like, just reminiscing on a lot of conversations that I've had with startup founders and how they're very much like, all right, we're just going to product. And then once we have the product right, then we'll turn on the go-to-market. Like, it's just a light switch that you can flip on and off. And it's like, you need to be kind of thinking about that at the same time. You know, it's not something that you can just turn on and then all of a sudden the leads just come funneling in. Yeah. So It is interesting to think about that. And on the other side, what you're talking about with the hacker mindset, especially in the startups, I have seen that. And I think those people, when you encounter them in startups, it's a joy to work with them, because a lot of times what you'll get are the other type that's like going to tell you all the reasons why we're resource constrained and you can't do that thing, that crazy idea that you came up with at 6 o'clock on a Thursday night when everybody was having dinner together, right? It's like, no, that's not possible. But then you find that person on the team that's like, oh yeah, like, hold on, I'll see if I can throw something together. I think we could do it maybe like this.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, it's happening. And like you said, you're literally creating something from absolutely nothing. It was an idea on a Thursday while you were having some dal and Indian food, you know? Like, and then Friday, it was kind of in motion. And then next Tuesday, it's actually a thing that you're talking about and you're touching and maybe you're demoing.
So I've run a bunch of different functions in my career. I ran product for years at companies. And there's two types of product people in companies. There are those who come bottoms up. They're usually software engineers or engineers by degree, and they think requirements and features, and they sort of build products from the foundation up. And then there are go-to-market product people, right? There are the people who their mindset is there is white space in the market. There is a need in the market. I understand enough of how the technology works that I can see a path forward. I was always that guy. Now, I wrote code early in my career. I'm very technical. I probably would have been a software engineer had I had a different upbringing and knew that was an option, right? I probably would have done something else. Instead, I became a hustler instead of a hacker. But what's really interesting is I think there's a certain amount of joy in knowing enough about the technology to know that it is possible, but not so much that you stop yourself and say, well, but it's really hard. Or, oh, but this other thing is in the way. There's a certain amount of value in ignorance in that. And, you know, that is entrepreneurialism. You know, entrepreneurialism at its core is just looking and saying, I'm going to make it happen. Like, I believe in it enough. You have to have this sort of suspension of disbelief where you're not afraid of failure. You're not afraid of getting it wrong. You're not afraid of hitting a wall. You just say, I want it to be, so I'm going to do it. And what's really interesting is my earliest forays into machine learning and AI products came from that, because I understood I was trying to accomplish this thing, but if I could get an algorithm to do it instead of a simple logic of tree in an application, it'd be this much better, right? You know, knowing it was hard, but be able to look and say, but it's so much better, it's worth trying, right? It's absolutely worth trying. And, you know, then just making it happen. And I'll tell you, when I was at Acquia, we created this product called Acquia Lift, which was a personalization and targeting engine for media companies. And it used machine learning. It was a multi-arm bandit algorithm to do it at first. And when I proposed this product, I met nothing but resistance internally. Nothing but resistance. CEO shut it down. Said, like, I don't see the value. I don't get it. He couldn't see it. He also, and then the engineers were like, well, that's really hard. And how would collect all that data to feed the algorithm, and what would do with it? So there were a handful of us who really believed in it, like really, really believed in it. It was one of my engineering managers, myself, one of the guy who ran my sales engineering team. And we set up things called gardening days. So every three sprints, we would have a dead sprint in between. So the fourth sprint was you could do whatever you wanted. And it'd be a big open source company. Most of us contributed back to open source projects when that happened. We used the fourth sprints to build the product, but we just believed it. Two sprints and we had a functioning MVP, like fully functional, and came to the company and said, I know you said no, but we believed in enough, we built it. And here it is. And it works, right? And it became, like, 2 years later, it was a third of the revenue of the company. And it's a great example of, like, if you really believe in it, then pardon my French, but put your ass on the line and just do it. Like, just go and make it happen, right? And we had to polish rough edges, and, you know, there were some things we changed about it, but that product ended up, you know, evolving and continuing to grow and is now a core part of that company's business.
Exactly. And you get to see how putting something into production so quickly gives you that feedback that you were looking for. And now people can't talk about why they can't do it because it's this thing that's in the air and it's not scoped properly, or it is something that is intangible, right? When you get something that's there, you throw it down, it's tangible. Look, here, we're getting feedback from it. It's a whole different conversation.
Exactly. So, you can take it to your like, for us, it was our biggest customers. I can go to them instead of saying, I have an idea for a thing. You know, NBC was one of our biggest customers at the time.
Yes.
A customer there who was really great at giving feedback and really was like a good partner who wanted things to work. So, and he would pull no punches on his feedback at all. And so he was the first person we took it to. As soon as it was functioning, we're like, oh, by the way, we mocked it up on your site. We're using your data and all this other stuff. And he's like, this is amazing. These are the 10 things that I don't like. It's like, and we just iterated it, right? And it's, you know, you can, you know, ideas are silver, code is gold. Like, just get it in production and assume it'll change. And you'd be amazed at what you can accomplish.
Yeah, and that iteration speed is what makes startups so dangerous, because you can't do that type of thing. There's a million reasons why you can't do that when you're at a big enterprise, right?
Absolutely.
And all that resistance that you faced, maybe when you're at a startup, you face the resistance from a few people on the team, but just the fact that there are not that many people at the company, you can't face that much resistance. Whereas if you're at an enterprise, you're having to jump through so many hoops jump through hoops of people's jobs. It's only their job to like kill your dreams.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And it's politics, because then companies honestly enough, it's politics that's the problem, right? Because you see it in big companies, yes. I worked, my biggest customer when I was an agency exec in the 2000s was Microsoft. And this is the Ballmer era. This is the Kevin Turner era. This is when Satya was just running the online services group, which owned Bing and a couple other things. And it was remarkable at how good they were at saying no to everything and telling you why everything was bad. And it was politics. It was literally just like, I don't want you to win, because then it may diminish my win. And it almost killed that company. Like, that attitude almost killed that company. And you look at what happened. It required them actually having a near-death experience and having Google overtake them in a bunch of categories and having Amazon overtake them in software infrastructure and IT infrastructure before they finally woke up and said, we can't do this anymore. And all the politics got pushed aside, right? But I've seen that even happen in small companies, right? It's very easy for people to give feedback or to make decisions that are not actually about the best interest of the company and the best interest of what you're trying to achieve. And I think that's the most important thing you can achieve as a leader in one of these, is don't let that stuff creep in.
All right, real fast, I want to tell you about the sponsor of today's episode, AWS Trainium and Inferentia. Are you stuck in the performance cost trade-off when training and deploying your generative AI applications? Well, good news is you're not alone. Look no further than AWS's Trainium and Inferentia, the optimal infrastructure for generative AI. AWS Trainium and Inferentia provide high-performance compute infrastructure for large-scale training and inference with LLMs and diffusion models. And here's the kicker. You can save up to 50% on training costs and up to 40% on inference costs. That is 50 with a 5 and a 0. Woo! That's kind of a big number. Get started today by using your existing code in frameworks such as PyTorch and TensorFlow. That is AWS Trainium and Inferentia. Check it out. And now let's get back into the show.
When people start saying no to things, ask why. Why are they saying no to it? Is it actually because they are protecting the business, or is it because they're protecting themselves? Right. And that's something I've seen that happen in, 50,000 person companies, but I've also seen it happen in 500 person companies. And so, that'll become a bigger hindrance to your success than anything else. I used to always joke, politics will kill a company faster than a bullet.
That's so good. So there is another piece that I wanted to get into, which was all around dealing with data teams from the business side of the house.
Yeah.
So there, as you mentioned, there's the software side of the house, and then you've got the go-to-market side of the house. And I know that you've gone through your career and you've been the stakeholder that's like what we would say on here, like the non-technical stakeholder, although you are technical in your own right. But in these cases, you're the person who needs things from the business side of the house, and you're working with machine learning and you're working with the different software teams.
Yeah.
And I want to hear from this side, because I feel like in the 205 podcasts that we've done, you're the first person that we talked to. And it makes me feel like a little bit ashamed that it took us this long to talk to somebody in your position, because it is very valuable. And we hear people beating the drum about it all the time, how important it is to take care of your stakeholders. Your stakeholders are your customers at the end of the day, especially if you're an ML engineer. You got to look after your data scientists. You've got to look after your so many different pieces, like your analysts, your marketing team, whatever it may be, whoever's got their finger in the pie on wanting to see the results of what is happening with the data products that are going out, that is you. Like you've seen the other side of it. And so now what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I feel like I've lived on both sides of the house, you know, both in building the products for a business, you know, both in my agency days as well as in product development, then being on the other side as a consumer of these tools, right? And as somebody who has set the requirements and said, listen, this is what I'm trying to achieve. And I feel like the biggest mistake that gets made by most teams is they get too deep too fast. And they start getting into a level of specificity around how something is going to be constructed without really understanding why something is being constructed. And you know, you think about the data world, you think about operational analytics and machine learning and these applications of machine learning and AI, right? It's very easy to work bottoms up. Like I have an algorithm, I have a certain way of reporting on things, or I have a certain data set or data structure. And that starts to drive what it is. And I see this all the time in marketing, for example, because marketing is like just overwhelmed by tracking data. Like the amount of like things, the touches we track and the interactions we track and the user data we track and all these other things, it is a soup of just tons and tons of data. Data is not insight. Insight is not action, right? And what you're actually trying to get to is an action, right? I don't care about the raw data under all of that interaction. I'm trying to understand how I get more people to buy my product. I'm trying to understand how to get, you know, focus so I can dominate a category as opposed to just spread like peanut butter across a larger universe. And I feel like what happens is a failure on both ends. I feel like the people asking for these things don't ask the right questions, right? And the people building the systems don't actually understand what it is these people are trying to accomplish. So my biggest advice to data engineering, data scientists, analysts, you know, people building these things is ask the five whys, right? There's this sort of interrogation technique around asking why. And then when they get an explanation, asking why that is true or why they feel that way. I think there's a sort of lost art for business requirements. We used to put so much emphasis on it pre-agile, right? Where we'd really unpack and understand and really document requirements, not just at a surface level, but why. And agile broke it. Agile is like so popcorn. It's like, I'm just going to move fast. I got to just go build stuff. That, you know, it ends up sending us down rabbit holes sometimes, or it sends us down forks in the road that are in the opposite direction of where we're actually trying to go. And I think, you know, data engineering and data science teams can do a better job of just stopping and asking, what is it you're trying to get to as an outcome? What are you trying to achieve with this? With an ideal state, how would the business operate more effectively if I were able to solve some of these things for you? Because what you start to find very quickly is they're coming with requirements and they're actually asking for the wrong things, right? Or they're asking for something and they're articulating it really poorly, right? The other side of it, though, I push on the business teams all the time to also do a better job of leading with those things, but then also asking better questions about what is possible and what's available, right? I just went through this at Tab9, where we have a really great data team that tracks a ton of really interesting data about usage and, you know, how are people actually living the product and, you know, what they're applying it for and where they're successful and where it's all anonymous, but it's really robust data we use to tune the product. And I just sat down with them and instead of coming in directed and saying, well, I'm going to do some product-led growth initiatives and I'm looking for X, Y, and Z. I didn't start there. I started with, what are you tracking? Why did you start tracking that? What does that tell you? How much data do we have around that? Because by me understanding even those foundational elements, it starts to give me better questions to ask and better requirements to put back on them, right? And there's this sort of funny thing around data and insight when you're not a mathematician, when you're not a statistician, when you're not an engineer, where you don't know what you want until you see it sometimes. So I encourage businesses very often to like do things like look over the data sets they have and just play Where's Waldo? Like, what do I have here? And what does this tell? That's really interesting. And it starts to inform the business in a way that is really striking. I wrote an article 5-6 years ago when I was at a company called MemSQL, now Single Store, which is operational analytics and ML and AI data store. And I wrote a piece for CEOs. And it got published, I can't remember which business publication published it, but it basically was calling them out and saying, you know, if data is the new oil, and you as a CEO don't know what data you collect and how and why, you're failing. Like, you're absolutely failing as a CEO. Because if we're in the 90s, we'd be talking about supply chain. If we're in the 2000s, we'd be talking about digital channels. Both of those required you to have a level of insight around what was happening in a portion of your business that was critical to its success. Today, that's data. That's 100% data. If you don't know the data sources and what you have and where it resides and how it can be leveraged, you're going to make bad choices. And I say that for the CEO. Now, imagine if you're the head of marketing or the head of sales, or you're somebody in the head of product and you have all this instrumentation around usage and your user. What do you do with that stuff? So I do think it's a two-way street.
Man, there's a lot to unpack there. Let's start with that. I really appreciate all the insights. And speaking of insights, I wrote this one down because I felt like it was a powerful phrase that you said, and it is, data is not insight. Insight is not action. And so it's like the end goal, if we're looking at it, like, what's the outcome we're looking for? What's the result we're looking for here? We want the action. The data is not, it's like a means, it's a stepping stone to get us to that action, but we can't get caught up in that data. And so the other piece to this, though, is I almost have like a, how do you juxtapose these two ideas that just earlier we were talking about, how you were able to build a feature in two sprints, get it out there, you got people using it, iterating on it, but then you also just said that sometimes we need to slow down and really make sure we're asking the right questions and not go deep into the how.
Yeah, you know, it's a tough one. It's the way I think about it is how much effort does it require for you to pull back the bow before the arrow fires, right? And, you know, I think Agile encourages a ready, fire, aim mentality when, even if you're moving fast, it needs to be ready, aim, fire, right? Not because, you know, you should have a perfect answer. Don't mishear me. I'm not saying you need to have a perfect answer before you proceed. In fact, quite the opposite. Like, it's okay to move forward when you only have, you know, a limited view of what's ahead of you. But two things are critical. One is, you don't want to waste energy on stuff that's not going to go anywhere, right? If you, and actually, because there's opportunity cost, right? It's not just the cost of time, but now you're pulled down a rabbit hole and you're trying to unpack it. And then you end up in situations where people want to justify the work they did before, even though the evidence is saying it needs to be somewhere else because they invested so much time and effort in things. And that stuff is dangerous, right? You know, we talk in software all the time about fail fast. You know, we should fail fast. I've never met a single company in Silicon Valley that actually was comfortable failing. So how are you going to fail fast and be okay? Like, it's really uncomfortable to say you went down a bad path and it's a dumb idea. It's really uncomfortable to say that. Just admit it. It's really uncomfortable to say it, right? And so I think there's a lot of value in just asking the whys enough that everyone feels like they're on the same page, right? And everyone feels like they understand the problem.
Same.
And maybe not perfectly. Right? You say, well, I understand the problem well enough to do my initial foray. I know it just well enough. And then what I'm going to do, though, is I'm going to assume that this is written in crayon, not in stone. And we're going to use it to continue to unpack the requirements. And maybe we throw it out. And that's something that engineering teams are really terrible at. Engineering teams get emotionally invested in their code. It's bits. Delete it. Like, it's okay. You can throw it out. Like, if it got you to where you are, there's more than enough value in the information and education it gave you that you don't have to maintain the code. And that's something that, as a product leader, I feel like was probably my biggest success, was early days and things saying, no, this isn't where we're going to land long term. This is just to solve this one customer problem today. We're going to re-architect this thing from scratch right away. but we know we can get this out fast. We know we can solve close enough of the problem that we're not going to like freeze ourselves in place and say, well, no, I have to wait 2 years until the final product is done. No, I've got a near-term answer, I've got a medium-term answer, and I've got a long-term answer. And, you know, you've got to kill your loved ones. I hate to say it, but like, if you really want to be successful as an entrepreneur, you have to be willing to kill the things you love, right? If there's something better on the other side of it, that a customer is going to be more successful with it, and you're going to end up having a better result from it, then don't be afraid to throw away the things that you created.
That's it. Don't be afraid to delete that code. It's all ChatGPT written anyway.
It's just bets.
Let's be honest.
It's just bets. It's okay.
Yeah. Incredible. Now, there is something else that I think is important to call out too when it comes to the interrogation of the data and almost like the interrogation of what you have. I've noticed that with myself when we are doing things and I can sync with people on what we have, it gives me strokes of inspiration on what we could do. Well, so it's like being able just to understand, okay, there's this. And then it's like you're able to put two and two together and say, you know what? If I could know that, it would be very exciting. And I think about it a lot with, I'll try and give a concrete example here. For example, if you've got your cloud platform that you're trying to get people to use, and you can get information on who is using the cloud platform, but you want to know what the journey is to activation, you want to see like, A, what's the biggest metric that shows us that if people do these things, then we're able to say like, you know, 80, 90% of the time, they'll go on to becoming a paying customer. So we need to optimize for that person within the first 30 days to do these things.
Yeah.
How can we just give them all the information that they need? How can we make big pop-ups on the product so that it points them to doing that? And all of that is huge, but you don't know what, like if you're starting from scratch, you don't know what the journey is. You have to figure out, do we have that data? How can we find that data? How can we know what those metrics are that we should be tracking? All of that is like, sometimes I think when I look at it, I'll get overloaded because there's so many potential things. And then it's choosing those one things and saying, okay, we're going to make a bet that this is the metric we need to be looking at. So I guess there's not really a question in there, but I feel like you may have some wisdom and you've done that before.
Yeah, well, I have. And actually, I think you just threw out a really critical insight, which is you don't know what you don't know, right? But if you approach it with the right mindset of, I'm going to start off with a potential answer and I'm going to be observant and really pay attention to what it's telling me, I will start to understand what I don't know that actually has value. And so, I'll give you an example of this. So the most common modeling use case that I do in marketing. So we talk about marketing as the right message at the right time to the right audience. But the irony is it's inverted in value. You know, we spend all our time thinking about creative or a right message, but actually like 85 to 95% of the value is targeting the right person. If you just target the right person, even with a mediocre message, you tend to get more sales. You tend to get more, you know, more product growth. Right time is the next like 5 to 10% of that. The last few percentage points is the right message. So we always spent our time on the modeling side on ideal customer profile. How do I identify the right customer for me? Because you don't want 2% of a market. You want 100% of the customers that you're an ideal fit for. You want to dominate something. And so I've worked in a bunch of, you know, I built these models myself from scratch when I was a management consultant for companies. I've used tools to do this. My wife works at a company called Matt Kudu that does this for sales and marketing professionals around like enterprise sales. And what we've always discovered is the same thing. So when you first build one of these predictive models, like I'm trying to figure out who my ideal customer is, and the sales and marketing ask is simple. I want to put 100% of my time at a customer base that is the highest likelihood to convert. I don't want to spend my time on, you know, 100 people to convert 5. I want to spend my time on the 5. That's the ideal state. But it's a spectrum, right? So when you first build these models, the best thing to do is collect as many characteristics about the customers you've been selling to as is humanly possible, because you don't know what's going to generate lift. You don't know which ones are actually the indicators. And I remember when I first started doing this enterprise software, I would just collect everything: firmographics, hiring data, technographic profile, anything about their product set, the verticals they sell into, any piece of data I could collect. And a pattern started emerging in all of this. It's been consistent for all the software companies I worked at in emerging technology, that the technographics are the things that always are the most important. So literally, what else do they have in their stack, right? That was always the most important. So I'll give you an example of this. A cockroach, we landed on, CockroachDB is a high performance, high scale, unkillable system of record, right? So it's a system of record database, right? Traditional OLTP plus. The dead giveaway of a customer that was an ideal fit for us had Oracle and Mongo. They managed their own data center and they ran Kubernetes. Those four things would feel like they're opposites to each other, right? But they actually worked, because this was somebody who had high scale, which is why they had their own data center. They had legacy applications, which they didn't want to mess up, but they were really forward thinking. They were modernizing. Their business kept evolving. They kept changing, which is why you'd have Oracle and Mongo, right? Because you had, unkillable system of record in first gen, and this sort of unkillable but not agreed system of record that you try to use on the other end. And so what was interesting about that is when I first started doing these things, when I first started seeing technographic data popping up as high lift, what you realize very quickly is how much you don't know. Like the very first time I built it, we didn't track who was running Kubernetes. We didn't track what cloud providers they were on. We weren't tracking, whether they were hiring for data center roles. Like we didn't have any of these things. But once a couple of them started popping, we were like, wow, that's really interesting. If that's generating lift, I wonder if ... right? And the wonder if then gave us requirements. So people, let's go get this data. Let's go see if it helps, right? And then some of it helped and some of it didn't. And it was great. And I think that's true. Timing is true for that. Messaging is true for that. I think that's actually true for even other things outside of marketing. Like when you think about, the AI stuff we're building at Tab9. So we use RAG in context. So when you're writing code, you're working in chat, you're asking for a recommendation. I need a function that does this. We started actually giving context awareness to things like documentation, to things like, your requirements docs, not just code. Like we started giving it exposure to other things. And what we discovered was, oh, interesting, context awareness around things like your geo instance is actually more useful than context awareness around code, right? So it's, you don't know what you don't know until you start experimenting. And then you have to be unafraid to say, okay, I'm going to add data, I'm going to add these things, I'm going to try it, and I'm going to keep tuning. But the one thing that never changes is, what are you trying to achieve, right? That ideal customer profile example I gave you, when I rolled it out at Nginx, we were getting a shocking number of inbound leads, shockings. Like, Nginx, as of now, I think 70 or 80% of the error runs on. So we had this massive pool, we just have to keep trimming. And my CEO came to me one day, we were getting it focused down, and he goes, I want to cut the number of leads that the sales team touches in half without changing the outcome. That was his goal to me. And we did it in 2 seconds. And we kept getting smaller and smaller, where their conversion rates just kept doubling every time we'd make changes.
Wow. Okay. It's almost, you're just following breadcrumbs in the beginning, trying to see what are the biggest drivers and what is going to give us the idea of who our ICP is. And then once you can zone in on one, it's like, I see this, whatever it may be, Kubernetes users. And Kubernetes users that are running their own data center, that means they have scale. That means that they're doing that. And then, add a little sprinkle of Oracle on there with some MongoDB, we're golden. We have found our fit. But you didn't get that on the first try. I really like that you're honest about saying it took you a while to dig through all of this data, and maybe you had one little nugget of information and you probably found, okay, people that are using Kubernetes like us. And
yeah,
I think for me, as I was listening to that, I probably would have stopped there and been like, all right, let's go get all the Kubernetes users. But you're saying, no, slice down, segment down as much as possible so that you can find that 100% of the market that you can dominate.
Yeah. You know, so there's another famous example of this, which was Netflix's recommendation engine. And that's something that everybody, I think, can really relate to. You know, Netflix's recommendation engine is really good. It's really, really good. When it first started, it was 100% based on likes. So it was like, did you thumbs up or thumbs down? Right. And what they discovered was, and I'd have to find the report, but I'm sure your viewers can search for it. They discovered actually that whether or not you played something all the way through, and if you played it multiple times, was actually more valuable data than what you explicitly said. So they discovered your behavior was so much more useful than your stated view of something. And that's another one that's known
Yeah,
up.
actually, I was thinking about that when you were saying it. It was like features, right? Like for recommendation systems, this is exactly what you can use that as a parallel here. What you're talking about for in this marketing sense of segmenting down and being able to slice down for the ICP, it's the same thing for like features if you're trying to build a recommendation engine. So there is another place that I wanted to take us. It's a little bit of a change of gears, but bear with me because you're building, you kind of drop some hints, but you're building a coding assistant that has access to so much more than just your code. And I know that I can only imagine how happy people are that an LLM can read their epics and their stories, and it can give them context. And maybe one day you can have some agents that will go and just do the epics and stories for you. But I don't know. Are you there yet?
We're there actually. We're not released, but yes, we have that. We have a lot of that stuff already built,
No.
and we'll be rolling out over the coming months. So,
Oh my God.
well, I'll back up and tell a little bit about the why this company and what they were going after, and then why I joined. I've only been in the company now a few months. So Tabnine is the originator of the AI coding assistant category. So the company actually released its first product 5 years ago now, and it was basically in parallel with the growth of LLMs, right? So as LLMs started to really demonstrate their power, the company founders had been focusing on developer productivity and automating as much of the developer software development life cycle as possible through other sort of data intensive means, but LLMs had the most promise. And you know, it's obvious, right? If you think about it, large language model, what does it need? It needs, you know, structure in the language. It needs repeatability in the language. It needs clear rules. Like the English language is a mess, which is why it's taken so long for generative AI to work with in the English language. But you know, programming languages are very rules driven. It works really well. So the company built originally an LLM to do code completions in the IDE. So as you type, you know, basically we'll type ahead of you. Really powerful, actually. Really, really powerful. Because, you know, when you're trying to write a function and you're trying to add data, you know, in fields and everything, it knows where you're going based on the context of what you have open. And where it's going, though, and the reason why I joined the company is AI. My belief is AI is going to change every job, right? Every single thing we do today will look a little bit different 5 years from today. It's the same thing we went through with digital transformation. It's not all scary. I think some of it is feels a little scary. But my view of it is it's not going to be a job replacement. I think about a lot of these things as like an Iron Man suit for the mind. Like they're really about accelerating you and accelerating your skills and your capabilities and automating away the mundane. That's the truth, right? That's what we're actually seeing. You know, these AI tools for software development have been around, like I said, 3 to 5 years now for the majority of the category. So we've seen this pattern. And what I really liked about what Tabnine was doing is they were looking across the entire SDLC. And say, if I had an AI agent that lived in the middle of everything, that lived in the IDE with you, but also lived in Jira and Confluence, and also lived in Datadog, and lived in, you know, your other APM tools, and then could read your logs and could do all those other things, you know, how smart would that AI agent be? So when you went to write a test, you know, instead of saying, well, I'm going to start writing a test, it would say, you know, we're going to write a comment that says, I need a test that does this thing, and I want it to be able to assess for these factors, and I want to be able to know it succeeded or failed based on these outcomes. It can actually do it because it has all the systems available to it, right? It's not just, oh, I'm going to write a dumb test. I actually know, oh, you mean you want to actually track the outcome from Datadog. So it will pull the data that comes back, right, and tell you what actually happened. Now, some of this stuff is still in progress, but that's the vision. The vision is, you should have an AI agent who knows how to do testing with you. You should have an AI agent that knows how to write good requirements with you. You should have an AI agent that does things like deployments and actually, you know, sits alongside you as a DevOps professional, is pushing it out and tell you if it's successfully deployed based on real world data, right? And, you know, all of those things, when it works really well, it's your patterns of behavior. It's the things you would normally do, but instead of you having to go to five different systems to do it, you've got this partner that works with you in actually doing those things. And what the vision for the company that we have is, in order for that to happen, in order for that to be done well, there are a few requirements. The first one is, we believe privacy matters, right? So unlike a lot of the public tools like Copilot and others, we don't collect any of your data. We will not share it. We will not change the model based on your data. So we are completely private. You want to deploy completely air-gapped? We do that. You want to go and deploy in a private SaaS? We do zero data retention. So we're really focusing on privacy because that's the only way we earn the trust to talk to all of those systems, right? Is if we are fully private. We also really focus on copyright. So our models, unlike the public models, have not been trained on any non-licensable data. So, you know, a lot of these larger, like the ChatGPT and others, you know, there's all this discussion of copyright because they've trained on stuff they don't have the right to. And you can debate whether or not, do they have rights? Do they have not? You know, a lot of that stuff will get settled in a court of law. But from our perspective, it wasn't even a law issue, it was an ethical issue, right? If you said that your code is GPL and anything that gets generated needs to stay GPL, we're not going to train on GPL. Right? We just won't do it. Because there are other ways of getting to that answer, right? And we see it. We see maybe a slightly lower performance for us versus others, but we actually have switchable models. So our platform can run across multiple models, and we've tested it. So if I go to a CIO and say, well, I can give you 7 out of 10 answers perfectly with Tab9, or I can, using the OpenAI models, get you 8.5 out of 10 perfectly, but one of them is legally safe and the other one is legally questionable, which one do you want? Right? They always sit a 7 out of 10 because the additional benefit's not worth the risk, right? Now, I'm hoping a lot of this stuff gets resolved. Our view of personalization is we can get to that 8, 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 by trading on our customers' data, by trading on other things we can license, which we own licensing from third parties. But we think it's the right mindset to have with this stuff because AI is going to penetrate every function in every company. And you have to do it in a way that really respects the requirements of the total business, not just the task at hand and what that is. And we believe that's really critical.
One thing I find fascinating about the ability to ingest from all these different places, like you were talking about, maybe it's your Datadog instance, maybe it's your CI/CD pipeline, you've got visibility into that, maybe it's the Jira. All of that, and a little bit of a sidebar, I 100% understand why privacy is so important. Like, I don't want you just sending out data to ChatGPT about my roadmap, and all of a sudden, GPT-5 now has, like, my 9 months ahead roadmap. Or, yeah. Well, I guess by the time GPT-5 comes out, it'll be obsolete by then. But I think you, more than anybody, understand why that is not cool. But coming back to the point, one thing I find fascinating about this is that when it comes to code, evaluating if it runs or if it doesn't run is so much easier than evaluating like marketing
totally
copy that is that good or is that not? Is that going to get somebody to buy better than what I could have created? I don't really know, but I guess it gave me a bunch of cool ideas and I can riff off of those ideas.
Yeah.
And when it comes to code, you know, it's very black and white.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And even where it's not black and white, like I had this conversation with a partner, another big tech company that we're starting to work with. And they said, well, there might be 3 answers that work, but one of them is preferred. One of them is better. That's where context actually really helps. Like, you know, we can actually set some guardrails and say, when a developer asks a question about X, the answer is always Y, right? Because, you know, for example, like I need a function that accomplishes this and, you know, does it in this way, right? Oh, we always use this API for that. We always use this system for that. And we always secure it in this way as a company. So you can actually set those parameters. That's stuff that we're rolling out later this year. We call it expert coaching or expert guidance, where you can set some parameters for those things. And that is possible, right? And now that's more of the gray area, right? But this is where the machines with the right context get smarter and smarter. And this is actually something that users don't understand. I can't tell you how many times I see users complaining about how the system is broken. And this is true when we get it for feedback in Tab 9, and we see it with our competitors, but I see it with people just prompting ChatGPT and getting bad answers. And what you when you look at it, you say, okay, the issue wasn't the system. You didn't give it enough context. It's like going up to a stranger on the street and saying, help me find a car. Okay, wait a minute. Like, who are you? What do you need it for? Who are you carrying? How often are you driving? Do you care about performance? Do you care about fuel economy? Do you care about size? Are you a greenie? Are you a muscle car guy? Like, there's a million questions you have to answer in order to do that. Or you feel like our learning around how to use AI is still stuck in this era of we expect an omniscient bot that's going to give us a perfect answer with minimal input. They're not there yet. So we're going to close the gap two ways, right? We're going to close it by being better consumers of these tools and giving them more to work with. But actually, I think this is where companies are really going to win over the LLM providers, is we can shape that. Mm. So for example, when someone starts asking for a function, we look at the workspace and we look at what everything else they're doing and say, oh, you're writing that function. You always write it this way. And that's the right answer. So really, we're going to give you that. So it's instead of having like a stranger on the street, this is somebody who knows you, who's worked at your company, who's been part of your team for a while. So they have a different context, right? So I think that's what's really exciting about AI, because you know, there are three components to all these things. There's the models themselves, there's the data they train about, and then there's the user experience. And the user experience includes prompt engineering, the shaping of all of this stuff, what goes in, what comes out, you know, all those other things. I think the models are going to get democratized very quickly. My belief, and I've seen this in every other part of technology in the last 30 years, I think the models are all going to be equivalent within 5 years. There's going to be no differentiation because they're all open source white papers. So we're all building the same stuff. The data sets, I think, are going to become more curated.
Yeah.
We're going to all license the appropriate stuff. We'll have access to the right things. People will get better about protecting their own data and using their own data to train the models. So it won't be everyone gets access to everything. I think really the space for entrepreneurs and for people building these products to win is still the UX. It's going to be in crafting the right experience so that you bring to it what is appropriate for you as a user to bring to it. We don't make you jump through hoops, right? And instead, we provide that additional context and we gather all that stuff. And the AI agents are great for this. Like, I'll ask you questions. You ask me a question, I ask you a couple questions before I give you an answer, right? That's going to be really exciting because that's when the things will really start coming together.
So it's so funny you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you, are you baking the philosophy that we were talking about earlier on making sure you're asking those five whys into how you're dealing
we're building them in.
AI?
Yeah.
So I figured as much. And earlier today, I was reading a blog post about the way that you evaluate coding AI. And I was remembering a conversation that I had probably a half year ago, maybe 8 months ago now, on how one of the strong evaluation metrics that people will use, especially when it comes to coding, but just in general, is if you accept the output. And this article that I was reading today was talking about how when they did a study, and I have to figure out what it is and cite the paper and stuff, but there was a study done on the amount of code that stayed in the code base suggested ChatGPT 2 weeks or 4 weeks after it was accepted. And what they've been seeing is there is a lot of tech debt that gets formed by just accepting Copilot's suggestions. And then later on, you have to go back and realize, oh, man.
That was a batch.
Who wrote this code? How did anybody let this get through,
I know exactly the paper you're talking about because I just posted it myself on social media. It was a great piece. It was a great piece of research around code quality.
Nice.
And my response to it, and I'll share with you exactly what I said when I posted it, which was, it reminds you that these are not a replacement for a developer. Once again, I use my comment where they're an Iron Man suit for the mind. If you are a terrible developer, you're going to insert terrible code, whether you wrote it yourself or whether an assistant coached you on it, right? You still have to actually make a good choice.
Yeah, whether it's from Stack Overflow.
Yeah, I mean, this happens all the time, by the way. Like, I can't tell you how many people copy pasta out of Stack Overflow and inject it. So this isn't new. Like, this isn't, the AI bots are just making it faster to do it. That's all they're really doing. And so there's a couple of answers to this. First and foremost is, as engineering managers, you have to be diligent. Who is on your team and what are they accepting and what are they putting in? It doesn't replace code review, right? And the AI bot can help you with code review. Specifically, you have parameters you give it. But, you know, if you have a bunch of very, very poor developers, all you're doing by giving them these tools is making them generate poor code faster. Your answer here is to get rid of the poor developers or train, right? It's one or the other. You either need to make them more effective or you need to get them out. The AI coding assistants, by the way, do on average save 20% total developer productivity, 20% total across everything. When you talk about writing code, writing tests, writing comments, evaluating code, explaining code, all these other things. So that all the studies I've got a white paper on this that we created at Tab 9, where I didn't do any research myself. I just went and said, what did McKinsey see? What did IBM see? What did Cambridge see? There's all these studies that have been done. And what you see very interesting is the data all is very similar and very consistent. And it's about 20%. So think of it, if you have 20% productivity savings on your mid-level software developers, that gives you more time to coach the junior folks, or it means you can fire 20% of your junior staff, right? One or the other. And, you know, get back to quality. Now, the interesting thing is I do think AI has an answer to this above that, which is when the chat suggestions come out, like when we actually suggest something, we do track whether it was accepted or not, because that helps us shape it. You can overweight who is valued in the response. So if you know that this is a senior developer, This is a coach, then their weight is given much higher priority over others, right? And this is where that coaching and context, I think, comes in really helpful, because we can come in and say, actually, this is what good code looks like, right? So when you're recommending a function, if you have three options, you know, generally from what's available in the wild versus this is what an expert developer on the team built, bias towards that. And that's where things start to, this is the UX stuff I'm talking about. This is where things start to get really, really interesting, because this is not a difference in the model. This is a difference in what we do with the prompt, the context, and then what we recommend back. And you can get very specific if you really want to in these things.
So then it makes complete sense that you would have these senior developers be weighted much higher. And it makes me think about how, yeah, like, of course you would. You want that to be the golden evaluation set. You want to be taking that bat to the lab and training with what they're accepting and what they're saying is okay. So,
yeah, look, I'll leave you with one thing on these AI tools, because I don't think it's just for us. I think it's going to be true in a lot of these other categories. I think there's this universe of tools that are trying to be all things to all people, right? And GitHub Copilot's a great example. Like, they don't want to be focused on a certain type of developer. They want to get the lowest common denominator, as many as possible, right? Because that's best for Microsoft's cloud business if they do that. They'll get a lot more people burning compute on Azure. Whereas someone like us who's focused on enterprise development teams, like high-performing enterprise developer teams, you know, they're going to want things that are more bespoke. They're going to want things that are a little bit more focused on them and how they work and the things that matter. So that's why we made personalization such a critical part of what we do, because we don't care about being all things to all people. I want to go and make every engineering team more successful as a unit, right? I want to make that entire engineering team more successful, not individual developers modestly more successful, right? And your example around code quality is a great example. I do not want to accept just generating more code. I want to know that the code that we are generating as an engineering organization is more successful. That is absolutely part of the parameters of these things. And I think that's where we're going to start seeing a difference in AI in general. You know, you can go and just tell DALL-E to generate you an image, or you go to Adobe, that actually has better curated content, knows what you're trying to do, knows stylistically what you want, and is going to ultimately focus on generating something that isn't just, oh, look, I made an image. It's a, oh, this is an ideal image for my use case, right? And I think that's where this expertise and the UX side is really going to come to the fore in the next 5 to 10 years, is companies like ours are going to say, we care about the outcome. We care about the output, right? And is it the right level of quality?
That user experience is a great thing to flag. And I hadn't thought about it until you said it, but it makes me think about how that is the differentiating factor at the end of the day. You have to have that strong user experience when everyone has access to the model. Unless you're just adding a feature into your already high-performing product that isn't leading with AI. If you are leading with AI, though, you got to make sure that the user experience is the strongest, because that is the differentiator. That's your moat right there.
Yeah, agreed.
I want to end with one last thing, which is, you've had some time in marketing positions, and you've specifically marketed to devs. You talked about how you really were looking for these three different pieces of information, but I want to dig a little bit further and ask if you found anything specific when it comes to marketing to developers. Have you seen any insights that you can share?
Look, I think, you know, I have marketed to developers, but I've sold enterprise software, right? So, you know, I think there's an important thing to note with large scale developer tools, which is they're not bought by developers. They're bought by their boss, or they're bought by their boss's boss. And what you learn very quickly is, selling complex technical products, you don't sell to one person. You sell to a sphere of influence. You sell to a group of people who make the decision together, and they all have different roles. And that's probably the biggest breakthrough I made early in my career, and something I advocate for anytime I talk to anyone going to market in enterprise software, is don't think you have one customer. You have a champion who really wants this product in because they have a problem they're trying to solve. You have a decision maker who's going to say yay or nay. You're going to have somebody who controls the budget, which might be different than the decision maker. Think about procurement in a large company. And then you're going to have users. And those users, you know, they can either push you in the business, or they can keep you out of a business if you don't win their hearts and minds. And so, like, selling to developers, a lot of my career has been, can I build a groundswell of trust and belief among my end user? Do they believe in this? Do they feel like this is something they want to have in their lives every day, right? Now, developers almost never have budget, right? So you, with that, can you activate them to become champions for you? Can you get them to push you in an organization? And then can you go to the engineering manager? Can you go to the CIO or the CTO? Can you go to the architect or the principal software engineer? Those people usually are decision makers, right? They're champions or decision makers, and help them understand the value you add. And so even when I coach my salespeople, like, look, know who you're talking to and know what they care about. Like, if you talk to a developer, like, you know, coming out of the AI place, for example, developers don't care if that code is licensable or not. They don't care. Like, they don't care if the code is being pushed out to OpenAI. They don't care about any of that stuff. Most developers don't last more than 2 to 3 years in a job. So they're not thinking long term. They're not thinking about these things. They're just thinking, look, I've got 10 Jira tickets I have to work through in the next 5 days, and I really only have time to get 7 of them done. Like, they're very focused on, like, you gave me a job, I'm trying to get through this job as fast as possible, right? So when we talk to developers, we're like, look, I'm going to help you get through the job as fast as possible. Now, I am going to do it in such a way that doesn't get you scolded in the future. Like, that is part of it, because the code quality is bad, or because you issued code that wasn't licensable, you know, those sorts of things. But when you talk to the CIO, you know, they don't care about developer satisfaction. They don't, I mean, I hate to say that, like, but they don't. Like, they are, those are machine parts to them, right? If you have 10,000 developers, they're like, yeah, I'll just hire another 1,000. Like, you know, but they do care about productivity and efficiency. We do remind them that you don't want to churn developers because that's expensive. And, you know, so you got to really know your audience.
Yeah.
And make sure that your value propositions resonate with each of them. Like, are you really solving something that they all care about? Because if you're solving something that only one of them cares about, and the other is a resistance to, you're never going to build a business. You just won't.
Shoot me straight, Peter. You good at golf?
No, I don't golf. I was a skateboarder. Do you think I golf?
I was about to say you sold out on us, and now you're golfing, selling to these CIOs
weekdays. Actually, you know, I thank God that most of the guys in charge in software decision making in the United States, at least, are Gen Xers who grew up the same way I did. So, my biggest hobby, I race cars now as a hobby, and I probably know more executives in the software through racing than I know through work. So, you know, it's I feel like adrenaline sports are the new golf for my generation, at least. So I'd be more likely to find
there we go
buddies on a kite board or on a snowboard or in a racetrack than on a golf course, which I'm grateful for.
So there is one thing I want to leave us with, which is I know you are hiring right now. You've got an incredible team of developers that are working in, you've got an engineering team remotely all over the world, I think. And then you've got a home base. Also, you've got a team in Israel. You're based in California, right?
Correct.
So if anybody out there is looking to join the rocket ship and let us know, hit up Peter, tell him you heard him on the podcast. It's been great talking to you, man. Like, there's so much. I've been scribbling notes a ton, which I normally don't do because I try and give my full focus and attention to the guest, but here there was a few that I was like, well, I have to remember that so that I can use it later and incorporate it into my life and how I do things. So thank you for coming on here.
Always want to be helpful.